talking about Worf.
Okay, this is about Worf, and what I was saying to you, I didn't really know very much about it, except that I had the impression, as in being in economics, that for a long time, that all this money that Worf was collecting and passing out for support of research and projects around the university was none of it was going to social sciences. And I think this must have been true, because there was a period in which we began to get some kind of concessions through the graduate school, access to some of the Worf money, and this was considered quite an achievement.
Mm-hmm.
Now, beyond that, I don't know about Worf.
When would you say, do you remember when that started?
I think when Bri Curl was in the graduate school as an associate dean,
uh-huh.
And I think he must have been fairly effective, because he was working on this, among other things. And I guess I could not tell you when that was, but it was probably middle 60s or something like that. I don't think we had much of a chance at this Worf money, and we were always kind of jealous and sniffy about that kind of an operation in the university.
I'm just laughing because it is true. That's what all the social scientists and humanists say. But just Monday, I was talking to John Lewis, and he seemed to feel that it has always been quite equally distributed.
Well, what's John's field? He was the dean of the graduate school.
Yes. And I was the...
Well, you can find these university administrators around who are quite sure that they give adequate thought to some field other than their own and so on, and you feel as though you're talking to an absolute stranger on them.
Well, that's what I felt, because I, after all, this is a common complaint.
We have not had, since I've been around, any dean of a graduate school who really was a social scientist. We've had some social scientists on the among the social associate deans, but
mm-hmm.
you never feel that you really had very much clout in the graduate
mm-hmm.
school. And they also had pretty good access to the Worf money.
Indeed, they did.
I don't know. Sometime you might make an effort to get some opinions around as to whether people in social sciences really feel that they have very much access to the sources of funding in graduate school. I'm sure they do now. And
you mean not just Worf, but any something?
Well, the graduate school has been characterized by a kind of professional elitism or something of the sort, and I guess there's some kinds of things that where you wouldn't even bother to go to the graduate school, because you figure you wouldn't have a smell of a chance to get any support from the graduate school for something you thought you ought to do as a professor.
Yeah.
But I don't know how much this actually affects it. How much this affects, I mean, the graduate school, I mean, this is one of those cases where you could properly say, well, we in passing on requests, why we've given equal treatment to all these fields, but nobody tells you how the requests get sorted out to begin with, whether people stay away from you.
Yeah,
sure.
Right.
You say, oh, there's no chance, so you don't put in any requests. But beyond that, on Worf, I don't know.
Well, it's quite serious. I have heard, for instance, that Harrington more or less put his foot down and said, you are going to give money to the social science.
I think so. I would expect so. I think it took somebody with some real clout. See, Harrington, the central administration, Harrington with Clodius as the vice president, they were pretty, I'm sure they... Other people thought they waited it in the wrong direction, because both social sciences were pretty strong. He would be in a position to make them listen to him. I don't think Worf intended to. I mean, I think they had rules, and they operated by their own, and that did not include these other fields. But I don't know. That's something you better ask somebody who's really studied the Worf before.
Yes, but it's interesting to collect views from
that. Yeah, sure.
As
especially when one gets this diametric opposite statement.
Well, you ask me in one kind of an area of work, and you ask John Willard, who's in something different, and we give answers
that
are part of our background.
Team, so,
yeah.
So he
well, you ask Bob Bach, and he probably would tell you that they give equal treatment to all the fields, and I think they do now, in a sense, do a lot more for social science, but a certain area of social sciences.
Mm.
I think. That gets a little far afield. We have developed in universities in the past, oh, since 1960s, eh? We've developed a segment of faculty members, and particularly researchers, who are very skillful at getting money from grants and this kind of stuff. I mean, this is something that takes a good deal of experience, and it takes a certain kind of person, and but the kinds of people who know how to put up the right kind of project request and so on and get money. And I think on the whole they're pretty happy with the graduate school allocation of resources.
I think so. It must be the same way with building requests, that evidently it really depends upon whether a person in a department is willing to go to the effort to develop a very coherent request for building. And if there isn't such a person, and if the dean doesn't speak up on behalf of that department, then nothing happens.
That's
clearly the truth of grants.
We're talking about my present department right now. We're talking about it in noon. I think we've been very badly treated, and I don't think we've done a very good job for ourselves, and I don't think that over the years the dean has been very interested in pushing this sort of thing.
You mean you're short of space even now?
Oh, terrible, terrible. When I moved out there as a professor, having been on the, professor with a lot of years of being on the university and so on, you should have seen the place they offered me as an office. It was hardly a closet. I mean, I wouldn't move in there. I mean, basically, I just wouldn't move in.
That's an ag hall.
That's an ag hall. Well, ag hall is scattered in four or five different buildings now. I don't mean ag hall. Agricultural economics is scattered in five different buildings. They can't get their faculty together.
I thought that sort of thing had been solved. I mean, that most departments have finally gotten their space out of it, but that's not true.
We talk about this mournfully every now and then. There was a time, I can't tell you when, but I suppose it would have been in the, certainly not after, much after the early 60s. There was on the building priorities list, top one in the College of Agriculture, and still fairly high, you know, like third or fourth or something like that, and the campus one, and nowhere at all, maybe in the building commission list. A building for agricultural social sciences, which is journalism, ag economics, rural sociology. And that was at the top of the list for a couple of years. And then it simply disappeared. We never had anything.
Is anybody doing anything about it now?
Well, we're trying to, Ag Economics right at the moment is trying to get a building given to us, a Lord Street building is going to be a vacant, I think it's part of the hospital complex.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And we're trying to get this assigned to Ag Economics, and I think there's representation, I mean, even today, I think there's some kind of a meeting where they were, I don't know what committee was involved, but we were making a representation of how badly we needed. There's sort of a general feeling that this is going to go to the Math Research Center or somebody else anyway. And that's what it is. So I don't really think, I don't expect to see it myself, I'll tell you that. I don't know how much longer I'm going to be a professor of Ag Economics, but I don't expect to see a change in the facilities in the next 2, 3, 4 years, something like that.
I think it's, I'm surprised that there isn't more complaint about it.
Well, you said yourself that how these things get listened to depend on the how well they're represented and the kind of the clout that you have behind them and the support and so on. And I don't think you've been in a very good position to ask for it. So, do you want to stop this and ask now whether we've got anything else we want to talk about?
Well, there is the library committee. You were talking about Lou Kaplan's chairmanship of it, and you might. Do you remember?
Well, what I remember about this was, in a sense, something like the campus planning committee. This was a committee that was elected, as partly elected as faculty members and partly appointed as deans. I think the composition of the campus of the library committee was partly elected, partly appointed by the chancellor. They were deans appointed by the chancellor, plus the director of libraries. And it was, when I got on the committee, I was sort of offended to feel that it was very much of a rubber stamp operation.
Oh.
That you'd have these proposals presented by the director of libraries, and we'd sort of talk about them a little bit, but we'd end up and do what he said, which is to vote for them. So very little independence. And part of it was just the way it was handled in an overt way. I think Lou would call the meetings of the campus planning of the library committee, you see, and he was the chairman, and he had somebody else who sat in the chair for him while he was there. And so I led what was considered, what I'm sure was a highly unsuccessful effort to recapture this this committee as an operation. I remember talking to my other members and trying to settle on a chairman who had enough clout really to run the show himself and to do this. And we never got very far.
You said you did get another chairman, but
we got Werner Sumi. And Werner was a bright man and able and all that sort of stuff, and he had enough prestige to do it and all that, but he was so busy doing his meteorological work and so on that he wasn't around much. I mean, so we elected, we never could get to him either. So it didn't really amount to very much. This was not a revolt that got very far.
And was it merely that you objected to being a rubber stamper, or did you really feel that there were things that should be, in regard to libraries, that should be done that weren't being done, or decisions that you didn't really
well
think about?
I guess, again, I think in terms of the way the processes you go through, the procedures you go through in arriving at a decision, many of these would be made pretty much before us. Lou would have considered all these, and he would present it and have a viewpoint, and he would dismiss the other views pretty much. I suppose it's partly a matter of personality. But we were arguing about certain kinds of issues. One, I suppose there's a perennial issue of the central library or these branch libraries.
Yes.
It comes up in all kinds
yes.
of ways. I came from agriculture, where we had a very fine library. I mean, in a functional sense, it was a library that gave us good service, and we were entirely sympathetic with his aims and so on, and he a lot of things he wanted to do he was unable to do, the librarian out there, because he couldn't get the money from Lou. Lou did have the purse strings, and the question of whether all of his requests for new books had to go through the Lou's office, you see, to be okayed and turned down or not, and things of that sort. Now, this kind of an issue kept coming up. I don't know what the merits of it are. The merits of a big university like this, a diverse one, is we do some of both, and that isn't consistent. So we live both ways. But Lou is always on one side of those issues. And member of the College of Agriculture faculty and interested in the college, and as a sometime member of the campus library committee, I didn't want the campus library committee to take action that would, in a sense, represent a view I wasn't satisfied with in the other view.
Yes,
I don't know how true that was, but other colleges. Of course, we've got a very nice building now, the Steenbach Library, and I don't know how the other parts of it are being done. And engineering's got a library. L&S never got into this kind of an act, though, the college library.
No, they had the whole
library, really, as part of the L&S library.
Well, now Lou mentioned an incident in which he thought the library committee could have performed and didn't, and I don't know whether you were on it at the time. Either Engman, I guess it was Engman, yes, suggested to him that the departmental libraries ought to be closed down. And he discussed this with the library committee, and I guess the library committee voted unanimously that in fact they would shut the, perhaps not all of them, but a good many of them. You remember this?
To close down
the departmental libraries, the little libraries, you know, in geology and geography and physics, that sort of thing.
Well,
let me finish the story, yeah. Because then when this was announced, there was a furor, and Atwell immediately, said, no, it's all right, we won't close down the departmental library. Well, Lou said here the library committee and he had voted on this more or less because it had been suggested that they should, I guess. And then their decision was overridden, and he felt that the committee should have been angry about this and gone and talked to him.
Well, one of the murky things of this kind of a question, all right, is the question of what kind of libraries are we talking about? I think there are probably some departmental libraries that are really very fine libraries, complete libraries. There's some departmental libraries that are just a collection of books on some shelves somewhere in the departmental office. And the question of whether the university as a whole, out of the university library money, should provide money to buy books that get put on the shelf in the departmental library where they are at the personal convenience of the people in the department, but nobody else, you see, no access.
Yeah.
I think this came up quite regularly.
Yeah.
And I guess I've been kind of strong for the smaller libraries that were scattered around, the ones that are, I think of as good working libraries. I guess I sort of object to the idea that to get a certain book, would have to go accommodate to some library rules that are set up by some department, you know, their own private library sort of thing. Now this is not, now I'm not sure about the geology and geography library. They had a quite a good site.
I'm not sure what libraries were involved.
Yeah.
It's just the idea was that the library committee had voted one thing and then Fleming had overridden it.
Well, we may be talking about different ideas of what a departmental library is.
Yes, except on this particular issue. You don't remember that.
No, anyway. I don't remember the issue.
Was George Mossy on the committee when you were on it?
I can't tell you.
Yeah.
Seems to me that he may have been, but I don't recall.
Yeah.
History,
so it was a question of
does history have a library? They must have a library.
No.
Well, Agricultural Economics has a library, a Taylor Hibbert Library, that's furnished entirely by contributions.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a general purpose working library. I mean, even in the field, it's kind of a select few, buy some journals and a few things like that. But I don't think the question of using university money for it has really come up.
Mm-hmm.
That may have been what we're talking about. We've been talking between us about the issue of where faculty authority ends and administrative authority takes up. I think we're getting this is becoming a more acute issue. We're going to have to face up to it. When under the university committee. Several years ago, we first started this process of revising university laws and regulations and gave it the name of faculty rules and regulations and had it come out of the university committee the redraft of this, essentially without any administrative input. I talked to Ed Young about these things and said, sooner or later we're going to have to decide where the faculty authority ends, and they're driving us into this thing by asserting the right to write the laws and regulations of the university, you see. And I used some examples, and some of these are coming up. One of the examples I used was in the faculty rules and regulations produced by the administration, the university committee under Clara Penniman, there was this section that had been in the regent rules for years and years, saying that the chairman of a department is appointed by the dean with a preferential ballot by the members of the committee, the members of the departmental executive committee. And my argument was, in again talking about procedures and so on, my argument was, well, now if you recognize that it's the right of the faculty to adopt legislation like this, and you also have to recognize that they have the implied right to amend it. So what if they come along and take this rule that we've lived by and amend it by saying, if the departmental faculty is going to elect its chairman? There's a difference, you see, between having a dean appoint what is, after all, an administrative officer with the advice of the members of the faculty, another one having the faculty elected.
Yeah.
Now, you may come out the same sort of way, but many cases we haven't, and it himself is one of those cases where a department could not solve its own problems, and so they put somebody else in deliberately put somebody else in to run it. And this was, they put Ed Young in there as chairman of the economics department on that basis. So he knew all about this thing. We haven't done anything. But now, guess what they've got in the current revision of the rules and regulations? A thing that says, chairman of a department shall be elected by the departmental faculty.
Really?
That's in there. Now, I don't expect that any faculty group is going to amend that. Because they all, you ask a faculty group whether the faculty ought to decide these things, and they'll always say yes.
Yeah.
But it's now in there, it's in the draft they're talking about or something. I don't know what the current status of this thing is, but this is just exactly what I'm talking about. Now, this becomes a pretty serious thing. If you're a dean, you damn well want to appoint your own administrative officer. And this is a collision. Yeah, I think that's right. We're on that kind of a course, and nobody's has shown much signs of backing away from it. Now, I don't know. I have sort of quit getting excited about these things but I suspect you go through the current revision, which is yet to be passed, but they're working on it right at this moment, and find more cases of this sort where what was formerly considered the prerogative of the administration is now being written into what the faculty rules as being the prerogative of the faculty.
Yes.
So then you come to the question,
who's going to decide which is going to be.
So Herb Shane's going to have to deal with that one.
That's very interesting. I'm glad you mentioned that. I think Dave Cronin mentioned that, whether in connection with his own chairmanship. I remember he said he had a run-in with Leon Epstein as to whether the dean had approved it after, or I've forgotten what the sequence was.
Yeah.
But so Ed Young isn't the only example. But what's been happening is that the faculty 99% of the time does choose its chairman, and the dean merely.
Sure,
but this way, it's being made a rule, which is quite different.
Well, what the faculty has done most cases is choose a chairman by having a preferential ballot and agreeing he's the guy we want, and that's the one the dean appoints.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite a different thing to have the dean in a position where he has to accept what the department elects or take extraordinary measures and so on. This is we've got some other issues when the dean has held up somebody's promotion.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody's department will recommend that so-and-so be promoted to a tenured position or something like that, and the dean says no, he can't do it, and for his own reasons holds it up and doesn't go any further. I think the current legislation says that the dean has to send these things forward. He has to ask the advice of the divisional committees and so on, all of which may come out counter to what the dean wants to do with it. And I don't know where you end up with it.
Do you think the faculty union people or cause has something to do with this kind of decision?
I don't know.
I mean, clearly it's an effort to give the faculty more control over things than it has.
It seems to me at the very worst time, because now we are suddenly the faculty becomes a minority group and the whole bunch of university employees, you know, we're outnumbered by the academic employees and all this kind of thing, all of which are feeling their oats too. It may be something like that. It may be a desire to assert your authority at a time when people are saying, well, we don't have any authority and we've got to go in for collective bargaining. I mean, maybe something like that. And I don't know. I think you can explain some of these. You don't have to go too far to explain some of these things besides saying, well, you got a different bunch of people in there now and they don't know what we used to do. I mean, most faculty groups, and this is true of committees, they are, the personnel, it depends on the individuals who happen to be members of the committee. And that changes so rapidly that what the committee does in 1 year may be something quite different from what it did 3 years before. And basically no carryover.
I think this is one of the most interesting things I find,
that
it is people
without
the body.
So I think we're probably doing things now out of sheer ignorance of what the issues were or what's been done before or why it's been done before. And that sort of thing.
You know, this makes me think that I would like to ask you about your experience during the TA strike, whether you had any at all beforehand, whether you had TAs, what you have to say about it. You didn't?
I did not use TAs in my own teaching or anything like that. I was not involved in the TA negotiations or anything in the university. I sat in on some of the early meetings and had some, as I said in some earlier tapes, the university committee had some discussions with some of the people who turned out to be leaders in the
TA. That's right, you did.
Way back when, before it took any shape or so on. We never understood them, they never understood us, so it was sort of a standoff.
But as a member of the Ag Econ department, you didn't have any?
In agriculture, they don't use teaching assistants very much.
I thought they might use some.
Well, we use some, yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. But basically, the teaching is done there by the professors.
Yeah. You know, you were saying some interesting things the other day. I have to talk about the LNS of the undergraduate campus, and you reacted to that, and do you remember saying that? You were saying the Ag campus also has undergraduates and
Well, at this stage of my life, I think the way the College of Agriculture has worked has always viewed its teaching programs and so on as the university at its best, and it's not at all like they do in LNS. Yeah, it's this one where basically the professors have built-in job that consists not only of teaching but of research and public service and so on. So their appointments cover all of these things, and teaching is only a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
So you get a very close relationship between teaching and what you're doing in research, which is, I think, the things that distinguish teaching in a good university. You've got people who are really working on things and teaching them at the same time. There's a strong belief that the professors do the teaching, and the professors correct the papers, and this kind of thing. Now, you can say this is inefficient and so on, but that's the way to get students and professors together, to have them actually involved in this sort of thing. In the College of Agriculture, students talk to professors. They see them, and they interact with them all the time. LNS, they never do. Students from all over the campus. I like it that way. Some people from agriculture, but some from all over the campus, and they're quite different.
What's the course?
It's a course in land economics. And it's a kind of general interest, and it's a survey course, and appeals to people who are interested in environment and all kinds of things. So I get a lot of different kinds. The thing that always amuses me is that I get so many people from LNS, so many students from LNS who come in and want me to write them letters of recommendation. And these are juniors and seniors, and I'm apparently the first professor that ever talked to any of them. I mean, this is literally true. I mean, I can't think of any other reason they'd come around to me, because I don't know them. I mean, I've had them in class and so on, but they just don't have this kind of an association. It's sort of normal in the College of Agriculture. That's the way it ought to be. We got into big arguments about, at some stage, I think this even in that, question of faculty legislation, and I think maybe I scotched this one, but there was some talk about the requirements for designating office hours or something like that. In the College of Agriculture, as far as I know, at least traditionally, we have never designated office hours for seeing students, because you're there all the time. You're supposed to be there all the time. And if students want to see you, well, they ought to be able to see you when it's their matter of convenience and so on. And you do not say that the only time I'll talk to students is at 10 o'clock on Tuesdays and Thursdays, you see, and the rest of the time
this really works, does it? I mean, you
sure
feel that people aren't
sure,
there.
I think so. I think so. I don't know. I mean, we've always done it this way. And I keep wondering about the kids who've got classes at 10 o'clock on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and they want to see somebody, but that's the only time he has office hours. I don't know how they get to him. Sometimes I'm difficult to find, but at least I make it. I see the students, and I tell them often in class, if you want to see me, why come around after class, and we'll make the appointment. And I've always got somebody out at the office who'll make an appointment or tell me that somebody's coming in and all that. So basically, we never had office hours.
And do students come in a good deal?
Oh, they come in more sometimes a year than others. Sometimes in the semester, you know, they come in mostly when they're concerned about exams and grades. Mm-hmm. And I'll have quite a few of them in before the end of the semester and things of that sort. And I'll get quite a few who come in and ask me about letters of recommendation for jobs they want. So I get quite a few. I don't know about maybe an LNS, maybe they have too many. Maybe it's a... In my class, I do not consult the students on things like papers. You know, if you assign papers and have to talk to each one about papers, that's a different sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't run into that kind of traffic. Well, we've always done the same thing in advising. I don't know really whether I'm describing the procedure accurately or not, but we designate in departments two or three, a handful of people who advise freshmen, people coming in fresh from the college, and they advise, they have quite a load of advising for freshmen to sort them out by departments and that sort of thing. But when they get to the stage where they're ready to choose majors, where we know the ones that are really going into economics and so on, well, then this advising is done by our own faculty, and not by an advisory service or anything like that. Now, I'm not sure that the quality of advising is any better, but at least it's a little more direct involvement of faculty and students, which is a little more that notion that the university consists of, the log with a student on one end and the professor on the other end and talking to each other.
Well, I know there has been a lot of complaints in LMS about the use of TAs and students not seeing professors.
Well,
some professors say they're there and students don't come and see them. That's another...
Well, I think this is possibly true. I don't complain when students don't come in to see me, but if I were dependent on students to keep me occupied, well, I would probably be upset. But I had TAs for a couple of years, and I quit using them. I had one good TA and I had one who wasn't good. I mean, in the sense of what he knew about the job and his interest and his personality and all that sort of stuff. But both of them, I felt, stood between me and the students. And I felt isolated. I mean, it's one thing to walk into a room and lecture to 75 students, see all those faces around, not have the vaguest idea about who they are or what their backgrounds are and other, anything like that. Another thing to have to get involved in teaching the, correcting their papers,
yeah.
Know who they are, yeah. Learn what they can do and what they can't do, and learn their faces by name and thing and things like that. And it's much more satisfying thing when you can do it that way.
And you are doing that now.
I'm doing that.
Yeah.
Now.
Well, that's great.
Well. It's the only way I feel comfortable with it. Otherwise, I feel as though I'm, I don't think I'm doing, that's the way that I think I have my impact on students, in part, but this kind of thing, that's one of the things I want to do. I want to feel that I've done something for them along my life.
Well, what's your research in?
At the moment, I don't have any research going. I mean, I'm...
But generally...
See, I just quit. I just quit one job, and now I moved over into this other thing. I've been busy teaching for this semester. My general areas of interest in research are both our public finance, public records, land records, title procedures, this kind of thing. And I've had a few interests in some of the foreign countries and undeveloped areas. And so
have you been?
I've been to a couple, and as a consultant on their land programs, that's kind of where my field is.
Mm-hmm.
So. Well, I kind of like that.
Kenneth Parsons, I need to read him all the time. Well,
I think we've run out, don't you?
Probably. Good times.